Christian greetings to each of you this morning. It's a little different setting here from what we're used to, gathering together in the house of the Lord. I chose to come up here. It gave me a choice, and I thought this pulpit looked a little bigger, a little more room for my notes. So it's not that I'm high-minded or anything, but it'll make it a little easier. Thank you. Honesty in finances. I don't have to tell you this, but you already know it, so I'm not sure why I'm saying it, except to remind you that we are living in a world that is full of financial scandals, fraud, and corruption. How can Congress leaders, congressional leaders, begin their political careers with little wealth, earn about $175,000 a year, and leave the halls of Congress 20 years later as multimillionaires? Try to figure that out. The math doesn't hold out at all. You see, the problem is that there's bribes and kickbacks that are so common, much too common. However, this corruption isn't limited to the halls of Congress. And so I believe the biblical call for honesty in finances is more needful today than ever. As Christians, we're called to reflect Christ's character, I believe, in all of our lives, including honesty in our financial dealings. And I think this means conducting our finances with I guess you could call it an honest transparency that's accompanied with fairness and truthfulness, even when it may be costly or countercultural, different from what the people are doing around us. Are you aware that the Bible has more to say? The subject of finances is mentioned more times in the scripture than any other subject, including heaven or hell or redemption. We could spend the entire day just looking at scriptures that focus in on finances. And, we wouldn't have time to really exhaust all of them. And we're not going to do that this morning. Simply try to look at some of them. Our approach this morning is to consider the biblical basis of honesty in finances. Then I'd like to move into thinking about some of the challenges, some of the temptations that we face as Christians related to this subject. And then I'd like to move on to some of the, some practical ways to embrace a lifestyle of honesty and righteousness in our financial lives. And then I'd like to end with considering some of the eternal rewards of honesty and finances. So first of all, what's the biblical basis of honesty in finances? We know that the Bible consistently upholds the importance of honesty, justice, and integrity in every area of life, including our financial dealings, all the way from the Old Testament teachings all the way up to Christ and the apostles in the New Testament. The scripture calls us to conduct our financial affairs with integrity. An integrity that's also supposed to reflect God's, God's character, in a sense, in our transactions and relationships. We know that in the Old Testament, there was a lot of laws. There was a lot of God established various laws that promoted financial integrity and prohibited dishonest practices. Maybe just consider a couple of them. The first one I think about is that there was a prohibition of dishonest scales and weights. Proverbs 11:1 says, "A false balance is an abomination of the Lord, and a just weight is his delight." You see, the Lord is really concerned when we're dishonest in our finances. And notice this verse, a false balance. What is it? It's not just a bad idea. It's an abomination to God. We stand under the wrath of God if we are dishonest, if we have false balances. So it's not just a bad idea, it's an abomination. But when we're honest, did you notice? The Lord takes notice of that as well. It says a just weight is his delight. He takes notice, it's his delight. Now do that today. We don't use the balances anymore, you know, scale where they would put a weight on the one side, you know, a 1 pound weight on the one side, and then you could put whatever you were selling, apples or whatever, on the other side till it balanced, then you knew that you had 1 pound of apples. We don't use that today. We use the electronic scales. But you know what? Even those can be, you can have dishonest. Now that's why you have on every scale, you go to a market, supermarket, wherever they have scales, what do you have a little seal on there for? Because there's a federal agency that looks at and comes with an honest weight, puts it on the scale to make sure that it is what it says it is. Does that take care of all dishonesty? No. You know the old trick that they say the butchers used when they put the meat on the scale, on the electronic scale, and they would put their finger on it, just another ounce or two, and they would end up being able to charge for more. Well, they end up charged for all the meat, including the meat in their finger. You know, that they bill for that as well. So there's different ways of people being dishonest. How to think of, there's just so many that we can look at. If you have a store or you're selling produce, are you tempted to take filling the box? Okay, they sell it by the box. You put the little apples, the ones that aren't very good, you put them on the bottom, and then you put the other ones on top, the nice big ones on top. That's a form of dishonesty. It really is. First impression is you look at that and you think, well, this is what I'm getting. And guess what? It isn't that. It reminds me, it wasn't long ago, I bought a, I'm trying to think what it even was. It was a box of something that I bought. It was some fruit or something. And I thought, I looked about the right amount in that box. Guess what? I got past the first layer or two, and what was on the bottom? A lot of fluff, a lot of, I don't know what you call it, that confetti stuff that they put in the bottom, and all it did is boost everything up. I was buying air from the bottom and the confetti, and I didn't get, I looked at what it looked like, how much I was getting, and it ended up wasn't being that at all. I think it's ironic how you can buy bottles of vitamins or whatever, you know, a big bottle, and you open it up, it's not even half full. I say it's a form, there's a sense in which that's a form of dishonesty. It's prevalent today. So whether we exchange goods or services for money, we really should try to think about it and be sure that the person that's what they're paying for is what they're getting. Think about it. Would we be willing to pay what we're charging? That may be a good question to ask ourselves. If you're selling an animal, you're selling a piece of machinery, you've had it, you know what the condition is, you know what the health of that animal is. Do you try to take and paint things up, paint over the rust before you sell that piece of equipment so it looks good? Let's make sure that you represented it fairly. Well, that's the prohibition on dishonest scales and weights. The second one I thought about, and that is in Deuteronomy 24. If you have your Bibles, you can turn to, we're not going to be looking at all these scriptures, but maybe looking at a couple of them. One thing I like about looking at the scriptures, there's something about looking at the scriptures is much better than just hearing it, just listening to someone give it. You look at it, and I think it helps us to remember it better. Deuteronomy 24. And I'm just going to read two verses here. These verses here, I believe, are a commandment, or a command, you might say, to pay workers fairly and promptly. Deuteronomy 24:14 says, "Thou shalt not oppress an hired servant that is poor and needy, whether he be of thy brethren or of thy strangers that are in thy land within thy gates. At his day thou shalt give him his hire, neither shall the sun go down upon it, for he is poor, and setteth his heart upon it, lest he cry against thee unto the Lord, and it be a sin unto thee. Notice how those poor people were expecting to be paid. They wanted to be paid on time. They were counting on it. The question is, are you paying your workers and creditors on time? I've heard of people already that talk about how they can use other people's money. You know, if you're just a little late on all your bills, you have an amount of money that you have, capital that you can be using for your own business. That's you're stealing really from them. What's expected? If you're unable to meet an obligation, and sometimes that happens. We run into a financial, somebody didn't pay us, so I can't pay them. Now what do we do? Well, we should go borrow if you need to. Make sure your creditors get paid on time. But what if you're not able to? What if you actually find yourself not able to do it? What do you do? Go to the person you can't pay on time, ahead of time, as soon as you know it, and say, you know what, I'm having a problem. My check didn't come. It said it's in the mail. But I didn't get it yet, and if I don't get it, can I work with you? Can I pay you some interest, maybe, if it's going to be late? Or offer to do whatever it takes to try to work out of an agreeable terms with them. If you don't, your Christian testimony is really at stake. It really is. It's greatly hindered when we're late paying our bills or wages. Maybe another question would be is, are you paying a fair wage? You might get to the end of the year and you realize that you have an employee here that, yes, you paid the agreed upon rate per hour, but you know, they went out of their way. They did an excellent job. They did an extra. They went beyond their calling. You get to the end of the year and you say, you know what? I really didn't pay them enough when you looked at what they got, and you give them a bonus. Why not? It's only fair. This biblical injunction here, paying a fair wage, became very personal to me recently. In fact, I had a very embarrassing incident that happened in my office about 18 years ago. I contacted someone that agreed to come to the office every week, sweep the floors, dust the dividers and the tables, and I asked what she charges. She said $13 an hour. Back at that time, 18 years ago, that was a fair rate. I said, that's fine. And so for the next 18 years, she cleaned the office every week, along with a helper that she had. And it was only a couple weeks ago that one of my secretaries told me, they said they were doing the 1099 to this person. I said, you know what? She comes every week and she only earned this much. Something doesn't seem quite, it just seemed like it's not very much. And so we looked at it and realized that here she's been still charging me $13 an hour for the last 18 years. And I spoke to her about it, and she said to me very sheepishly, she said, well, Gail, she said, I actually thought about it a couple times of talking to you and saying something to you, but I don't know, what do you call that? She didn't feel comfortable, I guess, for asking for more, because she remembered that she had agreed to charge $13 an hour. Well, I felt bad for her. With inflation, it should have been up to at least $20 an hour, maybe more. In fact, I asked her, I said, what are you charging other people? She said $20 an hour. So anyway, I not only got a clean office, but I got it for a good deal. So what was I supposed to do? You know, I didn't feel that way at all. I felt pretty bad. I went back, had my secretary, one of my secretaries get together everything that she earned. I knew how many hours she put in because I just divided by 13. And then I went back on each year, took those hours, and I figured, you know what? That's about 50 cents an hour. She should have charged me more every year to get up to $21. I figured she ought to be worth a little more than the 20 anyway. And so I went back and I calculated. Guess what? Came up to $6,500. $6,500. Then I thought about the fact that, you know what? If she would have had that money, she could have put it in the bank, earned some interest on it. So I really ought to give her some more. So I threw another $1,000 on top of that. And I made a check out to her for $7,500. And She was kind of surprised, I guess, yet very thankful. She appreciated it. And now, was I obligated to pay her anymore? You might say no. Honesty in finances. It was the only right thing to do. It was the only right thing to do. You know, we're tempted. We're tempted when we come through a deal or come through something, whether we're buying or selling, and we say, you know what, that was pretty good. I didn't lose anything on that one. I actually made out a little better than what I was expecting. You know, it's like, and I'm not opposed. If you put your farm up for sale and you were expecting 1 million and brought 1.6 because two Amish were bidding against each other, that's okay. I mean, you paid what the market was, you know, willing to pay, and I'm not opposed to that. That's all right. Or if you're at a sale and you happen to be the highest bidder for an item that nobody else needed, do I feel you have to go and offer them more because you think it's worth more to you? No, I'm not saying that. You gave them more than what they would have earned if you wouldn't have been there, so you actually did them a favor. That's just part of, you know, the economy that we have, the way we buy and sell. Just make sure that when you look back on what you've done, was it really fair to all parties involved? Number three. Third one is in Exodus 22:1. I'll just read this verse. It says, if a man, and this is a requirement to make restitution, in this sense kind of ties in with what I just talked about. If a man shall steal an ox or a sheep and kill it or sell it, he shall restore 5 oxen for an ox, 4 sheep for a sheep. Now, that verse suggests he stole it. It suggests that it was intentional. But you notice that what the penalty was? You talk about an interest rate. That was really high. You steal an ox, you had to replace it with 4 more, or whatever you took, 4 to 5 times the value that was taken. Now, hopefully we never steal an ox or sheep. What's our temptation today? Where you're sitting. How many of you are employees working for someone else? Let me see your hand. Okay, oh, quite a number of you. How can you steal from your employer? How can you steal from your employer? Is it possible to steal time? Can you? I believe it's possible to be dishonest and steal from our employer by handing in time and expecting to get paid for time that we weren't working. Yeah, it was time that we were, you know, got a phone call, a personal call, or maybe we were kind of checking up on our emails or catching up on the latest WhatsApp message or news or something. And yet, you punched in the morning, you punched out in the evening, and you didn't deduct any time for the time that you knew was personal. Now, I know the law says, what is, you're supposed to give 10 minutes, I think, for your employees. It's an old law. Maybe it's even changed by now. You're supposed to give 10 minutes break time in the morning, 10 minutes break time in the afternoon, you know, for them to, in our office, we don't have any break time. But I tell my workers, look, that's what the law says. That's okay. I have no problem with 10 minutes. Use it for personal things if you want. If you get a phone call, that's okay. In between, if you need to do something personally, that's all right. A personal friend walks in and they want to talk for a few minutes, that's okay. But you know what? It's quite another thing if it length, you know, it goes into 15 minutes, 20 minutes, or longer, and yet you still didn't take anything off your time. Still got paid. I say that is stealing. That is stealing. It really is. Think about that. Number four, another area that was also a warning in the Old Testament about, against moving boundary markers or encroaching on other people's property. Deuteronomy 27:17 says, cursed be he that removeth his neighbor's landmark. You know, one of the purposes for a landmark was to prevent disputes in the future of what was agreed upon in the past. What's the application today? Well, yes, we have deeds for our properties that have the markers, you know, where it shows where the corners are. That's okay. But it's possible for people to encroach on neighbors' properties. In fact, if you have a yard, I found that the grass keeps growing over and over. It keeps getting into the farmer's field that's next to me. And every now and then, we've got to trim it back. You say that's such a minor thing. It is. I guess it is. But I think there's other areas that maybe we could think about. How to prevent disputes in the future. One of the applications is to have clear agreements I'm not talking about necessarily limiting just to landmarks. I'm saying having clear agreements with, maybe it's for a neighbor. Maybe it's, maybe you share a driveway or, some other, you work together on some things. You know, who plows the snow? Who pays for the repairs? When the macadam needs to be replaced or repaired, who does that? Well, you both use it. It's good to have clear agreements between people, because otherwise, what can many times happen, finances, okay, get in the way of good relationships because you don't have a good, clear agreement. If you're in a partnership, make sure that you have a clear buy-sell agreement. Someday you're going to leave that partnership, or your other partners will too. I'll guarantee it. Someday you won't be in it anymore. We'll be gone. Let's say you decide to leave the partnership. Or your partner decides to leave. What is the right buyout? The time to decide what that is not when one of you decide to leave. You know, it's so easy to get involved in business maybe with someone else. Think about what's going to happen when one of us wants out. I don't care whether it's a involuntary, you pass away, or whether it's voluntary, you decide to go and, you know, raise rabbits or something. You just decide to get out of it. It's not what you want to keep doing. Do you going to charge goodwill for the business? You helped to build it up. You started from scratch. It's worth something. You sell this business to a neighbor, to someone else, a competitor, for example. They're willing to pay you for more than the inventory and the equipment value because this business is an ongoing business. Buyer walks in the first day, opens a key to the door opens, the phones are ringing, the orders keep coming in. Customer base is still there. How do you value that? Now, as accountants, we have ways of calculating what that generally is. But if your agreement doesn't say what it's going to be, I say that's when your finances is going to end up, perhaps, you may end up not being able to come to an agreement on it. So the best time to decide what the terms ought to be, not necessarily the dollar figure, but the terms, the best time to decide that is right at the very beginning. Or if you haven't done it yet, do it now. Why? Because you don't know if you're going to be the buyer or the seller. You don't know if you're going to be the goose or the gander. You want to make sure that the best time to arrive at what's fair is when you don't know if you're going to be the seller or the buyer. See? You're going to be careful. You're not going to be too greedy for what you might get, because those are the terms you're going to have to accept if you leave. So I say you can negotiate it best without bias if you do it before you know who's leaving. That's a little bit off the subject maybe of honesty, but I find that people, and I've gone down this path with businesses, where when it's time to sell, what the business is really worth, people are not really honest with themselves. And it makes it hard for them to be honest with their partners, because they, all of a sudden they're looking for a big sale and a big windfall, and they think it's worth a whole lot more than what it really is. They're not being honest. Number five. Another one you have in the Old Testament is the condemnation of bribery and partiality in judgment. Exodus 23:8 says, "Thou shalt take no gift, for the gift blindeth the wise and perverteth the words of the righteous." Now, he's not here opposed to accepting a gift, a Valentine's gift or a Christmas gift or a birthday gift or something like that. No, he's talking about where people give gifts for the purpose of distorting one's judgment. You know, bribery. We've heard much in the news in the last couple of years about the two-tiered justice system in America. Is it? Truly? Yeah. Might be a couple more tiers, more than just two. Millions of dollars were paid to the ex-president's son. Why? Not because he knew a lot about the subject, the business he was in, but it was in exchange to his father's influence. And the evidence is undeniable, undisputed. You know, there have been cases where money was paid, gifts were given to leaders in order to receive special treatment. And unfortunately, bribery is not limited to politicians. God condemned both the person that gave the bribe and also the one that received it. So you might say, well, I shouldn't do it. But what about if you're on the receiving end? That looks pretty attractive. I mean, all I have to do is, you know, yeah, get a little bit of money to get paid off. I know of someone, this is going back years ago, I remember, it's a story I never forgot. Because this, I was going to call him a brother. It wasn't my blood brother. Anyway, let's just simply put it this way. I know of someone that bragged about how, if he's ever stopped for speeding, he had a little trick so he wouldn't get fined. Pulled out his wallet. Behind his license, he had a folded up $100 bill. He'd get stopped for speeding, pull his wallet out, pull the license out, and he'd make sure that the $100 bill was underneath the license as well, hand it out to the officer, hoping that the officer, of course he's going to see it, would just quietly slip the $100 bill in his pocket and say, you know what, maybe next time you ought to just slow up a little bit, you know, and give the license back to him again. If the officer sensed he was being bribed, wasn't going to have anything to do with it, he said, what's this? What'd you give me $100 for? Oh, that was a mistake. Here, yeah, I kept that in the back of my wallet here in case I had needed. It was a lie. He was prepared to lie if need be, so he wouldn't be, you know, charged with trying to bribe the policeman. Is that right? No, we know. We know right on its face it's not the right thing to do. Well, there's more, many, many more scriptures we could look at in the Old Testament. Principles that God has given, I believe, that reflect God's concern for justice and fairness and honesty in economic transactions and relationships. I think they also reveal something about the character of God. I think they do, of truth and righteousness, and who delights in integrity and abhors deceit. In fact, if you read the prophets in the Old Testament, time after time they spoke out against financial dishonesty and oppression, calling God's people to repentance and justice. Amos condemned those who, I believe he said, sell the righteous for silver and the poor for a pair of shoes. Micah also, in Micah 2:2, rebuked those that covet fields and take them away by violence, and houses and take them away. I think these passages reveal God's heart for the vulnerable and his judgment against those who exploit or defraud others for personal gain. And I think at the same time, as we read these, it challenges us as well to examine our own financial practices to make sure that they are aligned with God's call for righteousness and compassion. What about the New Testament? Of course, that's what we basically follow in our practice today. You find a lot of examples where Christ himself and the apostles affirmed and in fact expanded on the Old Testament principles of financial integrity. Jesus taught that our heart, attitude, and inner character are what is ultimately matters, not just our outward compliance with the law. Jesus taught that our financial practices reflect the state of our hearts and our allegiance to God or to money. I have to think of, we're going to turn to it, we don't have time. But the parable of the unjust steward in Luke 16, he was very shrewd. And he actually commended the steward's shrewdness by using worldly wealth to secure his future in that. But at the same time, he said, the problem is you cannot serve both mammon and God. You cannot serve money and God. It just doesn't work to try to have an allegiance to both of them. And so he challenged his followers to be faithful in the unrighteous mammon so they could be entrusted with true eternal riches. If you think about the apostles, they consistently upheld the importance of financial integrity and warned against dishonest gain. In fact, the Apostle Paul instructed the Ephesian elders to support the weak. And He also remembered Jesus' words that said, it's more blessed to give than to receive in Acts 20. He also warned against the love of money as a root of all kinds of evil and temptations that can lead people away from the faith. So you realize that what you have in your wallet, wealth, can destroy a person spiritually. It has that potential. Or it can bless. All depends on how we relate to it. Well, James rebuked the rich that exploited their workers and lived in luxury while withholding wages from their laborers. I believe these New Testament teachings build on the Old Testament foundation of financial integrity, but they also expanded even beyond that. And while the Bible clearly calls us to honesty in finances, I believe that living out these principles that we looked at here, living out these principles can be really challenging in the fallen world that we are living in. Because we face pressures, we face temptations and obstacles that can potentially compromise our honesty and righteous living and financial dealing. I'd like to consider some of the temptations that we face today related to honesty and finances. You know, we may be tempted to conform to the cultural norms. You know, this is common. It's like, you know, there's some people that really get a bad rap for the kind of business they're in. How many times do you hear a car salesman really be, you know what, they're really honest. Yeah, sales, that's a good job. That's a good job to be in. They're really, no. They're known for their dishonesty. In fact, even I know I've heard of some auctioneers are known to be dishonest, you know, acting like they have a bid when they don't. And that kind of thing, they get caught once in a while, but they say, well, that's norm. That's normal. No, it's not. Not for the Christians. It shouldn't be. And in a business environment that prioritizes profit over people or that tolerates cutting corners, it can be difficult to maintain a commitment to honesty and fairness. Maybe I'll just mention a couple of the pressures that I think we do face, some questionable practices. One of them is misrepresenting our products or services to make a sale. I've talked a little bit about that already, you know, the apples and what they look, how you arrange them and that kind of thing. But the fact is that salespeople face this every day. It's a daily challenge to fairly represent your products. Or making unrealistic delivery schedules, promising unrealistic delivery schedules when you know you're not going to be able to get it done in time. But to make the sale, you act like you will. I think we can do that. You know, down deep, you've got other commitments you're going to have to do. And yet, here you're selling another one. I say it's a form of dishonesty. It's unethical. In fact, I appreciate salespeople that are willing to admit the limitations, you know. And just tell me what the advantages of this model is or disadvantages over that one. And I'll make a decision on it based on my judgment. But be careful. It's so easy to downplay your competitors and highlight all the negatives on their products, and all that you share on yours is just the positive things. You say, well, that's what you expect of a salesman. No, you shouldn't. You should rather be a type of salesman that's honest and say, you know what? I'd like to sell this to you, but, you know, I realize the capacity of that product is going to be more. This doesn't quite do as much, but we'd be glad to sell it. And in fact, service after the sale is worth more than the sales. All right, you can put a little plug in for that, but then make sure you give good service. Make sure you give it. Number two, withholding information or deceiving customers or clients. I think the golden rule comes into play here. Think of it this way. If the shoe was on the other foot, if you were the buyer and not the seller, would you be sharing any information, or would you want them to share information with you about maybe something that's not what it should be or whatever? I believe that many repeat sales, I'm talking about customers that stick with you, many repeat sales are the result of an honest salesperson. They are. I think they are. Number three, compromising on the quality or safety to cut costs. You know, when you cut on expected quality, you're cheating the customer. When you're not giving them the quality that they're expecting, that's cheating. When you compromise safety, you're risking the health of your employees or your customers. Yeah, you might be saving a couple dollars, cutting a couple corners, but are those dollars worth it if you're the cause of an accident or injury? I think these pressures can be especially strong in cultures where corruption is widespread, or when, you know, ethical standards are just pretty lax. As Christians, I believe we may feel like a minority or an outsider if we refuse to compromise our integrity for the sake of fitting in or getting ahead, but we still ought to do it. The scripture in Philippians 2:15 says that ye may be blameless and harmless. That word harmless means innocent. That ye may be blameless and innocent, the sons of God, without rebuke, in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation, among whom ye shine as lights in the world. You see, we're supposed to be lights in a world, reflecting God's character and values, even when it's costly or countercultural. What are some of the personal temptations that people face? Maybe I'll just mention a couple of them here. One is cheating on income tax. Being an accountant, you'd understand why I put that on the top of the list, because sometimes we do sense it. It shouldn't be that way. And in fact, if we have clients that we know deliberately cheat, we're going to tell them the next year, we won't do your tax. In fact, I won't even do it this year if I know they're trying to cheat. I won't be a part of it. Got to be honest. And there are plenty of ways to cheat on our income taxes, but that don't make it right. Unfortunately, there are some tax preparers that actually participate in the cheating. I've heard already of preparers that agree to, you know, inflate the contributions or inflate the expenses or take away some of the costs. You know, that would, if we wouldn't report 10,000, that would really save you about 30-some% of that or whatever it might be. And in exchange for that, say we'll split the difference. Charge extra for the tax return because they were knowingly filing it wrong. It doesn't pay. You might think it's a short-term payout for them. Tell you what, in the light of eternity, it's a high price. It's a high price that's going to be paid for those kind of actions. Now, there are many legitimate legal ways to minimize one taxes, especially farmers and business people. You know, they kind of have an advantage over a lot of other businesses. They don't have to inventory their feed. They can buy a whole year's worth of fertilizer and feed and seeds or whatever in December and write it all off that year because they had a good year. Is that legal? Is that okay? Yeah, it is, because that's what the IRS says you can do. There's no problem. Now, if you take a business person and he has inventory, he goes out and buys a whole bunch of inventory at the end of the year. That doesn't help him because he's supposed to report that and deduct that from his expenses that year because it's still on the shelf. He can't deduct that until the year he sells it. See, so there's differences there. Farmers can do it. For the one, it's legal. For the other, isn't. Buying equipment right before the end of the year, writing it off under Section 179, expensing it all that year, that's legal. That's okay. In fact, I believe that proper planning is good stewardship. I think God wants us to be good stewards of the finances we have. So it's not wrong to utilize some of these ways of saving taxes, but just make sure it's legal. Just make sure it's legal. There's actually some things you can do that appear to be illegal, but they actually are legal. I see I'm not going to have time to cover all this. Let me just give you one of the ways that sometimes people question. Let's say that you're selling a business, you want to sell your farm or whatever, and you decide you want to give some of it for the kingdom, God's work, okay, kingdom interest. Let's just say that you decide you want 40% to go to the charity. Let's say, it don't matter what the numbers are, whatever you gift to charity of your real estate before you have settlement. So if it's $1 million sale and you get 40%, that means at settlement you're only going to get 600,000, right? The charity's going to get the other 400,000. You don't pay tax on that 400,000 of income because you didn't get it. It went to the charity. But it doesn't stop there. The IRS code law says that when you gift to charity something that's a capital gain item, like real estate or goodwill or something like that, you can not only take that 60%, let's just say your gain was 100%, you'd have 600,000 of income to report on that $1 million farm sale, but only 600,000 you're going to report. Now, because you gave 40% to charity, the value of what you gave to charity, which is how much? 40%? $400,000. That 400, you get a receipt, you get a deduction of 400,000 as an itemized deduction in addition to your contributions that you can take off. So now we had 600,000 we reported, would have been reported. We now take the 400,000 that we gifted to the charity. You take the 400 off of the 8 off of the 600, what do you have? You're only paying tax on your taxable income only went up $200,000. Yet you stuck 600,000 in your pocket. Is that fair? Is that legal? Guess what? It's legal because that's what IRS says. You might say, well, but I didn't pay tax. It doesn't matter. It's a double deduction. But it's legal. That's what I'm saying. So it's important in our finances that we're honest, but it's all right for you to structure it. If you would have taken that sale, let's say you would have reported the whole thing. You have $1 million income, and you say, oh, you know what? I should give $400,000 to the charity. You end up with $600,000. What do you end up? What do you end up paying tax on? $600,000. Would you rather pay tax on $600,000 or $200,000? Pretty simple. Pretty simple to figure out. What I'm saying is there's various things like that. Just make sure that they're legal. There's scams. There's people that promote sometimes things that aren't legal. We shouldn't have anything to do with it. Another one, I'll just mention this one quickly. This is something that if you're old or getting old, it's somebody older than me, and you're thinking of selling your farm to your son, all right? You can sell your farm to your son while you're living. Of course, you paid much lower number back in the boonies when you bought it, you know, many years ago. Your gain is still going to be high, even if you sell it to him at a fair price. Even if you put the price in half, you're probably still going to have a capital gains on it. One way is to sell it while you're living. You pay tax on it. So if you have that, you know, I don't have to go through the numbers, but you understand. You have to pay tax only if you sell it while you're living. What about if you wait? What about if you give him a purchase option and you say, look, I'll sell it to you. It's worth $2 million, but I'm going to sell it to him for $1 million. I'm going to let you start making payments to me, but we're going to do a purchase option. We're not going to sell it to you while we're living. We're just going to have an agreement that when we pass away, when our estate is settled, then you have the right to purchase, to get the deed of this farm that's worth $2 million, as of today, and you're going to get it for $1 million. The purchase option says, when you get the property, and by the way, when you sell a property from an estate after you pass away, you get a stepped-up basis. It don't matter what you paid 100,000 years ago. If it's worth $2 million or $3 million at that time, let's say it's worth $3 million by the time you pass away, you get a stepped-up basis to $3 million. The estate, the heirs, the children could actually sell that property for $3 million, and there would be no income tax. Why? Because you get that step, what's called a stepped-up basis. So, with a purchase option, what you do is you say, look, we're only going to charge you $1 million. And by the way, you can give me payments toward that a while, down payments. Down payments are not taxable, by the way. So you end up getting the money, even while you're living. Don't pay tax on it, it's a down payment. When you pass away, he has the option, he doesn't have to. If he doesn't decide he wants a farm, you give him his $100 million back. If he paid it all, gave all the whole million during your lifetime, you'd have to pay the $1 million back while you sell the farm to the third party. And that's okay. But if he takes it, what we do, we say, okay, it's now worth $3 million. He's only paying for $1 million. What's that? That's a third of it. So what we're going to do, we're going to sell a third of the property, which has a basis now of $1 million. We're going to sell it for $1 million, no income tax. We take the other $2 million value, we're going to gift it to him. That has a basis of $2 million. So all of a sudden now the basis in the son's hands is $3 million, but he only paid $1 million. Does that sound right? You might say, well, he only paid $1 million. That's not what the law says. The law says if you gifted it to him, and whatever it was worth at the time when you did the gift, whatever that is, if you died, anytime you gift property, the basis goes along with it. All right. I'm just saying there's things like that sometimes you hear. Just check to make sure it's right. Make sure it follows the rules. If it is, then it's right to follow it. That's being honest with your finances. All right. Let's keep moving. Another area of temptation is to mislead investors or lenders about our financial situation. If you're in the need of borrowing money, let me give you some advice. Be transparent about what you're really at. This is especially true. Bankers, they learn what questions to ask so they can find out whether you're really, you know, whether it's a worthy lending relationship, if they want to take the risk or not. Borrowing from individuals, not so much. Many of the lenders, people that are older, they got extra funds, they're willing to loan it out, and you're willing to borrow it. And I find sometimes there's people that are deceptive in where they're really at. They don't disclose all the back bills that aren't paid yet. Yeah, they might give a copy of their tax return from last year, but guess what? The old feed bills that aren't paid yet aren't shown yet, so you really don't show a loss because you didn't pay them yet. And then you go to borrow money, it looks like, oh yeah, we're still making it, you know, when you're really not. And they give you an impression that everything's okay when it's not. I mean, just all I can say is, if you've got money and individuals come, and especially if they're offering you a little higher interest rate than Anabaptist Financial is going to pay you, then be careful. They might be trying to exchange hot air for cold cash. Just be careful. That can happen. All right, another area of temptation is to renege on our debts and financial obligations. Now, this temptation can really be pretty strong when we're facing financial pressure or hardship, or when we feel like, you know, we deserve more than we're getting. We can even, you know, somehow rationalize our dishonesty by telling ourselves that everybody does it, and it really doesn't, you know, make it right. Or we'll pay it back later. I've heard of people stealing that way from, you know, taking money out of the till for businesses and that, and say, well, I was only borrowing it. I was planning on returning it. Yeah, they kept borrowing every year until they got caught. The scripture warns us in 1 Timothy 6:10, for the love of money is the root of all evil. And then we're also called to be content. In Hebrews 13:5, it says, let your conversation, that means your life, be without covetousness, and be content with such things as ye have. For he hath said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. Yes, we're called to trust in God's provision and timing rather than resorting to dishonest means. Now, how do we cultivate financial integrity and honesty in our finances? You know, despite all the challenges and the temptations we face, I do believe as Christians, we can be faithful. We can cultivate a lifestyle of financial integrity that honors God and at the same time blesses others. I'd like to give just a couple practical ways to grow in our honesty and righteousness in our financial dealings. Maybe at top of the list here, and that is, seek God's wisdom and guidance. I think a lot of the traps, a lot of the places where people go wrong in finances is that they follow their own thinking. They follow their own ways rather than, you know what? Did I pray over this? Did I seek God's face on this issue? My mother used to say, before you make important decisions, sleep over it first. Well, sleeping over it gives you a little time to let your emotions kind of get down, you know. You go look at something, it can look really bright. It looks like, oh, that's what I want. Oh, that'll make me feel good. Then you wake up the next morning after sleeping at night and think about, you know what? Even without prayer, yes, even ungodly people can wake up the next morning and say, you know what? But I'm going to have to make payments on that. Is it really worth it? I mean, maybe I'm buying more than what I can, you know, trying to bite off more than I can chew. And so they get, but praying over it, I believe, is even better. I think we can expect the Holy Spirit to be able to help us to make the right decision. We need to acknowledge our own limitations and biases and submit our plans and desires to His will. Proverbs 3, 5 and 6 says, trust in the Lord with all thine heart. Lean not unto thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge Him, and He shall direct thy paths. I believe that when we prioritize God's perspective and values above our own, then we're better in a better position to discern what's right and resist the temptation to compromise. How do we seek God's wisdom and guidance? Well, I think that praying about them is just, like I mentioned, I think that's maybe point number one. Look at the scripture. Are there any scriptures that talk about this issue? And think about it from a biblical perspective. As I read these scriptures, you know, I encourage you to read Proverbs when it comes to this subject. There is so many nuggets of truth there, so many principles that are given that we can use today. You say, you know what? Maybe it wouldn't be good if I do that. Maybe that isn't quite right. Maybe it's a little shady. Seek counsel from mature brethren and believers who can offer godly wisdom and accountability. Be attentive to the promptings and conviction of the Holy Spirit as we navigate the financial situations. And then finally, after you've prayed about it, you've made the decision, and things didn't work out the way you were hoping to, you know what? Maybe God has another lesson he wants to teach us. He might take us through a series of, in our journey of life, some difficult things to go through. Why? It's not to make us bitter. It can make us better as we submit ourselves to his sovereignty. In other words, if we're not responsible for what happened, avian flu came through and wiped our chickens out. You know what? Now, you maybe should think about that before you get into it and borrow too much money on it. Do you have money? Can you risk? Anytime you go into a new venture, you ought to be thinking about, what if it doesn't work? Am I putting my family, myself, at undue financial risk? Be careful that you don't, that you're honest with yourself as to how much debt you really should have. So I say, seek God's wisdom and guidance. Number two, also cultivate a heart that values honesty and generosity. I say, cultivate a heart. Our heart is deceitful and desperately wicked, the scripture says. If we're not careful, we'll be running down the wrong paths. Let's cultivate a heart that values honesty and generosity above personal gain or self-interest. And I believe that our outward actions then flow from an inward character and priorities. So essential. Psalm 51:6 declares, "Behold, thou desirest truth in the inward parts, and in the hidden part, thou shalt make me to know wisdom." You know, God is not only concerned about our actions, but he's also concerned about the motives and the attitudes that are behind them. Cultivating a heart of integrity may involve regularly examining our motives and desires related to money and success. And be ready to confess to the Lord if you sense, you know what? There's an area here, I think maybe I was just being greedy. I was tempted to be greedy or, you know, envy or dishonest, whatever. I believe that practicing gratitude and contentment, recognizing that all we have is a gift from God, is to be used for his glory, our blessing and his, also for his eternal purposes. Develop a generous spirit that's quick to share and slow to hoard. You say, what's hoarding? Well, it's a hard line. It's a hard thing to know. How much savings should a person have? You know what? I'm more concerned what you're doing with it while you have it. And And if you get to the end of life, there's nothing wrong in your will to give everything to your children. But you know what? If you've got more than what maybe is good for them to receive, think about it. Don't put them in a position where they can lose out spiritually because all of a sudden they got a big windfall. You know, they say that people that win the lottery or get big inheritances, within 5 years it's gone. And they're worse off at the end of 5 years than what they were before. Why? Because they got used to a lifestyle and a lifestyle that was so easy, easy come, easy go. When you get to the end of 5 years and the money runs out, what do they use? They rely on the plastic that's in their wallets, the credit cards, and they get themselves in debt and find themselves very difficult to get out of. I say, be honest with your finances. I say honest with the vulnerability of giving too much to your children. Leave some of it for kingdom interests. I see a lot of people that on their wills, they don't just say give it equally, but they say, but there's a limit. I don't want no more than $150,000 or $200,000 per child or whatever it comes to, whatever you feel comfortable with, that it isn't going to give them problems. Be honest with what the Lord might tell you on that relationship, that respect. Practice transparency and accountability. The third way to cultivate financial integrity is to practice transparency and accountability in our dealings and relationships. The Apostle Paul describes measures he took to ensure honesty in finances, to ensure financial accountability in the collection of the saints. He said there in 2 Corinthians 8:20, he says, avoiding this, that no man should blame us in this abundance which is administered by us, providing for honest things, not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. He recognized the importance of being above reproach and maintaining a trust of those he served. How does this work out in shoe leather? How should you be transparent? Number one, if you're married, be transparent with your finances with your wife. I know of some men that don't tell their wife, they're afraid their wife won't sleep good at night, so they don't tell them all the problems they're, you know, running in the business and how things aren't working out, and they try to hide some of that to make her feel better. Only it's when she realizes you've been deceiving her for the last 10 years, how do you recover from that? Confession. It's the only way to do it. It's hard. It's hard. If you are a church leader, you have funds that you're using for the church, every now and then, we hear of individuals, trust, I'm talking about treasurers of businesses, deacons in the church that have been dipping in the till temporarily, just to help themselves. Don't ever do it. Don't ever do it. And make sure that your books are audited every year. If you are a deacon and your books are not being audited by somebody every year, you should demand it. Yeah, I feel that strong about it. It's for your protection. It's for your protection. So you say, well, what do they do? Who do you get to do it? It doesn't have to be a certified public accountant. It could be people, brethren in the church. I thought about an article that I wrote, I don't know how many years ago, on the auditor's work. Exactly what the auditor should do, and step by step, exactly what ought to be done, how they ought to sign it off. I'm going to let these papers here, and you can help yourself after the service. Maybe I'll put them down here in the stand or something. And help yourself. If your deacon isn't here and you want to take one along for him, take one along. Because I feel very strongly that auditing records is very important. It's part of helping to maintain an honesty and transparency. Communicating clearly and honestly with our clients, customers, and investors about our financial situation. I talked about some of that already. If you don't, it's one of the surest ways to ruin your Christian testimony. Establish checks and balances to prevent any one person from having an unchecked control over financial accounts. I know some businesses are too small. They have the secretary takes care of everything. She makes out the bills. She collects the money. She pays the bills. You only have one person doing it. All I can say is keep your eyes on the books. The more that they know that you're every now and then looking over things, you know what's going on, you actually minimize the temptation of being dishonest in finances for them. There's so many tricks that are played out there, you know, where people, secretaries, set up bank accounts in other cities under a name that's very similar to a name that you deal with. So checks are going out to Farmer Boy. Checks are going out to Farmer Boy, but they're not going to the Farmer Boy that you deal with. They're going to another Farmer Boy account in another state. Checks all look good. How would you ever catch it? I say, help your people that are handling your finances to maintain an honesty. I believe that as we practice transparency and accountability, we create a culture of honesty in our financial affairs and integrity that honors God, invites trust and respect of others. I need to get on to the last point. What are the rewards of honesty and finances? I think there's a number of them. I'd like to just mention three of them very quickly. Number one is a clear conscience. That's one of the blessings of being honest with your finances. So I say one of the greatest rewards of honesty in finance is the peace and the freedom of a clear conscience. And when we conduct our business with honesty and transparency, then we can sleep soundly at night, knowing that we have nothing to hide. Proverbs 18:1 says, "The wicked flee when no man pursueth, but the righteous are bold as a lion." You know, if you engage in dishonest or unethical practices, what's going to happen? You're going to live with the fear of being caught. You're going to experience anxiety, guilt, and shame. And that will erode your mental and emotional well-being and rob you of a joy that you should be able to experience, and a peace that you should be able to experience. In fact, I know some that actually, when they realize the gig is up, they're getting caught. It's exposed. What did they do? Committed suicide, or at least were tempted to commit suicide. Doesn't solve any problem, only makes a bigger problem. As followers of Christ, we're called to live with a clear conscience before God and others. The Apostle Paul said, I herein do exercise myself to have always a conscience void of offense toward God and man. The second one, another blessing of honesty in finances, is that we experience thriving relationships. Thriving relationships that are based on trust, respect, and mutual benefit. I believe that when we conduct our business with honesty and fairness, we build a reputation for reliability and goodwill that just, you know, it attracts others. And it makes it the people that you're dealing with, even if things got tough and things got not good for you, the economy was, you know, really in the slumps, they're coming to you because they know you're going to be fair with them during that period of time. So I say when we prioritize honesty and integrity in our financial dealings, we create a foundation for long-term, mutually beneficial relationships with our clients, customers, partners, and employees. In contrast, those that engage in dishonest and shady practices, they might gain in the short term, in the short run, but they often burn bridges and damage relationships in the process. And they may find themselves isolated, distrust, and even sued or prosecuted, depending on what the crime was. Another final one, and that is the eternal impact of honesty in finances. You know, ultimately, the greatest reward for financial honesty and integrity is the eternal impact that we can have with God in God's kingdom. So when we prioritize our financial assets with honesty, generosity, and righteousness, we're actually participating in God's work of redemption. Yes, we are. We're helping him. We're doing what we can to share the gospel, share the good news of salvation. People will be ready to hear us. Can you imagine witnessing to someone that you pulled a shady deal on and later he realized you really kind of pulled a bad one on him? Is he going to want to come to church? Is he going to want to hear anything about salvation? No way. You wouldn't get 3 feet with him. It just wouldn't work. In the parable of the talents, Jesus commended the faithful servants who multiplied their master's resources, invited them to joy, a share in the joy. And I believe he also warned of the consequences of the wicked and the lazy servant who squandered his opportunity to be a good servant. As followers of Christ, we're called to seek first his kingdom and righteousness. Use our time, talents, and finances to make an eternal difference. In conclusion, I believe that financial integrity, honesty in finances, is an essential quality for followers of Christ in a world that often prioritizes wealth and success over righteousness and compassion. While this call to integrity may come with challenges and temptations like we talked about, I believe it is possible to cultivate a lifestyle of honesty and righteousness through dependence on God and attentiveness to our hearts and practical steps of accountability and excellence. You know, ultimately, honesty in our finances is more than just avoiding a scandal or maintaining a good reputation. It really is aligning our hearts with God's purposes and partnering with Him in His work of redemption and restoration. It's about using our resources that He has given to us for just a short period of time here to advance His kingdom and to store up treasures in heaven. Perhaps you have some question or your comment you'd like to add in a couple minutes here that we've left. If not, you know, as we navigate the complexities and challenges of financial dealings in a falling world, let's seek God's wisdom and guidance and cultivate a heart of honesty and generosity, and at the same time pursue excellence in all that we do. May our lives, our businesses, be a testimony to His goodness and faithfulness, and may we experience the joy and the freedom of walking in integrity before Him and others.